Well, brethren, by way of introduction today, I'd like you to imagine in your mind a scenario. Imagine that you're having a conversation, you know, with a friend, someone that you know well, but your friend is telling you about someone that they know that you're not familiar with. You know, this is someone either they work with or an acquaintance that they have, but it's not somebody that you know. And in the course of the conversation, your friend says something like this. So, you know, this guy I'm telling you about, I'd have to say he's a rather jealous person. In fact, I'd say that he has so much jealousy, you could probably say his name is jealous. Now, if you were to hear a phrase like that, how do you picture this individual in your mind? I'm willing to bet, if you're like me, the picture that comes to your mind is someone who is consumed with envy. You're probably imagining someone who is very selfish and self-centered or immature in how they handle things in life. They may even be an angry or bitter kind of person. You know, so you probably have a very negative picture of what this individual would look like. And that's, honestly, that's how I would picture this as well. Ironically, though, this same terminology the Bible uses to describe, you know, God himself. And in fact, if you look in the New King James translation of the Bible, you'll find that the word jealous is used particularly to describe God 9 different times. It is also that the word jealousy is used 15 different times to refer directly to God. The Bible also even says, it says at least one time, if referring directly to God, his name is jealous. Now again, that's something we would normally never associate with God, because again, when we think of jealous or jealousy, we have this very negative carnal picture in our minds. But yet the Bible also uses this terminology to refer to God. So what we're going to do today is to look at this particular subject and understand what the Bible means when it refers to God as being jealous or having jealousy. I understand the differences between this and what we think of as get carnal envy, but also learn a very important lesson about what this tells us, not only about God's character, but about our relationship with him. So if you'd like a title for this sermon, it's Godly Jealousy. Again, Godly Jealousy. Because, as I mentioned, when we think of the terms jealous or jealousy, we don't get a very negative picture in our mind. We're picturing someone with envy, and again, we're picking a very carnal, negative kind of person. It's not something that we would associate with God at all. So let's first of all kind of draw a distinctions between what the Bible refers to as envy, or you know, carnal jealousy as we think of it, and what it means when it's referring to God with these English words. Because we're going to find, you know, the Hebrew and Greek words at times are different. But again, let's understand the difference in the meanings here. So let's start off, first of all, turning over to James chapter 3. It's James chapter 3 and verse 13 is where we'll start. And we're going to start looking at what the Bible tells us about envy. Again, the typical picture that we have in our minds when we're thinking of someone being jealous or having jealousy, we're thinking of envy. So we start in James chapter 3 and verse 13. Who is wise and understanding among you? Let him show by good conduct that his works are done in the meekness of wisdom. But if you have bitter envy and self-seeking in your hearts, do not boast and lie against the truth. This wisdom does not descend from above, but is earthly, sensual, demonic. For where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing will be there. As we can see, this paints a very negative picture. But notice here, when it talks about envy, it directly associates it with self-seeking, with selfishness. And the reason of that is, if you think about the concept of envy, what we're normally referring to with that term, is normally this is a person, or just say if we apply this to ourselves, you know, we're typically looking at something someone else has. You know, maybe it's a possession they have. They have a, you know, what we think a nicer house or a nicer car, or they got a nicer job, or maybe we're jealous, you know, of their spouse or the wife or the husband that they got, you know. And in our mind, we feel like, well, I deserved that more. You know, they got it, but I was more deserving of it, and that should have been mine. You know, and they shouldn't have gotten it. I should have gotten it. Because basically what it is, it's a selfish desire to take what that person has because I deserved it more. You know, and it's really rightfully theirs, because, you know, this person rightfully owns it, but we feel like we were more deserving. You know, and so we have this selfish carnal desire, we want to take it away from them. And again, that's an important distinction when we start distinguishing, again, you know, envy or carnal jealousy that human beings have versus what the Bible is referring to as God being jealous. That's an important distinction we'll see here. But as we see here in these verses in James, this is a very negative, carnal, destructive, you know, thing here, this carnal envy. And this is not only poisonous to our, you know, spiritual and mental health, it can be downright poisonous to our physical health as well. So just to briefly notice that, turn over to Proverbs chapter 14. Again, Proverbs 14. We're going to read verse 30. A sound heart is life to the body, but envy is rottenness to the bones. Notice it's a very destructive thing. It's not only, you know, damaging to a person's, you know, mental and spiritual health, it can be downright damaging to their physical health as well. Just a very negative thing. In fact, we'll see that the Bible describes this as literally the exact opposite of God's mind and character. Again, this, you know, quality, what we're referring to here as envy, is not something we would associate with God at all, because it's literally on the list of characteristics that are the exact polar opposite of the mind of God. So if you'll turn over to Galatians chapter 5, we'll notice this. In Galatians chapter 5. We're going to start reading here in verse 19. And what we have here is the list of the works of the flesh. It says, now the works of the flesh are evident, which are adultery, fornication, uncleanness, licentiousness, idolatry, sorcery, hatred, contentions, jealousies, outbursts of wrath, selfish ambitions, dissensions, heresies, envy, murders, drunkenness, rivalries, and the like, of which I tell you beforehand, just as I also told you in times past, that those who practice such things will not inherit the kingdom of God. Now notice here, again, it makes it very clear. These are the qualities that are just not going to be even acceptable in God's sight, will not be a part of his kingdom. It's the exact opposite of his mind. In fact, we won't continue reading here, but if you read the next couple of verses, it contrasts these qualities with, you know, the characteristics of God's character, of the fruits of the Spirit. It's like basically the polar opposite. But again, as I mentioned, one of the things to notice here, again, is this selfish quality about it. Again, let me share with you the meaning of the Greek word here that's translated as envy here in the verses that we just read. It's transliterated into English as phonos. It's P-H-T-H-O-N-O-S. It's Strong's number 5355. And according to the Complete Word Study Dictionary of the New Testament by Spyros Thahiotes, here's how it's defined. Envy, jealousy, pain, felt malignity, conceived at the sight of excellence or happiness, is incapable of good and always is used in an evil meaning. In other words, there's nothing good or positive about this definition. But notice how I talked about it was pain at the sight of seeing excellence, you know, or seeing success. Because what it is, again, is that this selfish desire to take. Because we see someone else who's been successful, they've been blessed with some, you know, possession or job or some position. You know, so they've gotten some kind of honor, something good. And we feel like, well, that should have been mine. You know, I deserved it better than they did. And I should have received it and not them. So it's this selfish desire to take it, you know, and that's why, again, it can be painful, you know, seeing excellence or good, because they got the good and I should have had the good, and we want to selfishly take it. But the reason I'm kind of pointing this out is we need to understand, when we think of the difference between what the Bible refers to, again, as jealousy or envy in regards to carnal human beings versus the jealousy or being jealous it refers to as God. There's an important distinction here. And understand this whole concept of selfishly desiring what is rightfully someone else's and wanting to take it. This is not a concept that would even really apply to God by definition. Because, see, the reason is there's nothing that's not rightfully God's. He owns everything. He is the supreme power in the universe. You know, he's the source of everything. So he can rightfully say everything is his. So the very idea of, you know, well, they have something and they shouldn't have gotten it and I want to take it, again, this by definition wouldn't even apply to God. So just a note, notice first of all in Exodus 19. I want you to notice that God is rightfully the owner of literally everything. So Exodus 19, and we're going to read verse 5 here. Now, the context of the story here is when God is initiating, you know, with Moses, that, you know, he wants to make a covenant with Israel and make them his chosen nation. But in discussing this in verse 5, he makes this comment. Now, therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice, keep my covenant, then you shall be a special treasure to me above all, because all the earth is mine. Now, notice he's promising them in this covenant, you know, if you obey me and follow the rules that I lay out for you, I'm going to bless you. You know, I'm going to rain down blessings on you, make life very good for you, and give you all these wonderful things. Well, he's basically saying, I can give you all this because it's mine, because I own it all, and I can rightfully give it to whoever I want to, because all the earth is mine. He's saying he owns everything. Now, realize, when we understand this concept, this isn't just about the natural resources, you might say, of the earth. This includes the people. This includes everything. Turn over to Psalm chapter 24, and we'll see this. It's Psalm chapter 24. We'll start reading in verse 1. The earth is the Lord's in all its fullness, the world and those who dwell therein. Notice the people as well. For he has founded it upon the seas and established it upon the waters. So again, it's not just an issue of, you know, the wealth, or you might say the physical resources of the earth is his. We're his as well. You know, the people, everything belongs to him. And I mean, if you stop and think about it, not just, you know, the physical creation, but in the spirit realm as well. Of course, you know, him and Jesus Christ have always existed. They're eternal. They had no beginning. They'll have no end. You know, but they then created, you know, all the angelic world and everything else. So he can say he's the originator of all of this. And even if you look at positions, you know, in terms of authority, you know, now God and Jesus Christ are, you know, as Christ told us, he and his Father are one. In other words, they're one in mind and in nature and in character of who they are. If you said, you've seen me, you've seen the Father, because, you know, they act and think the same. They're not equal in authority. You know, as Christ said himself, my Father is greater than I. You know, and that didn't just apply because he was a physical human being. Even after he's resurrected and back to being, you know, back to being a God being, he says numerous times, you know, that the Father is his God. You never see the Bible refer to, you know, that God the Father looks as Christ as his God. It, you know, Christ is his servant. So you see this superior subordinate relationship that, I mean, you can demonstrate from Genesis all the way to Revelation. You know, sometimes people want to debate that issue, but that is something you can clearly demonstrate from Genesis to Revelation that has always been the case, that always will be the case. But my point in this is, even though, like, you know, Jesus Christ has unique roles, you know, that are, you know, separate from the Father, how did he receive those roles? You know, as Christ even says, you know, the Father appointed him to sit at his right hand. He has given all authority to me. In other words, the Father delegated this to him. My point is that there is nothing that the Father could, you know, inappropriately or unrightly want to take from someone else that is not rightly his. You know, that concept just simply wouldn't exist because, again, he is the ultimate authority in the universe. You know, he's responsible for the creation of most everything. And even in the case of Christ, I mean, he still delegates authority to him. So Christ has the roles that the Father has appointed to him. So, again, the concept just wouldn't even apply of him wanting to selfishly take from someone else. So, again, that's an important distinction when we look at, you know, of jealousy applied to God versus jealousy, you know, envy, that's a carnal quality that's applied to us. But as I mentioned before, we typically think of, you know, someone being jealous or having jealousy. We're thinking of a very negative carnal quality. We generally don't ever even in our minds tend to associate God, you know, with that because we have this negative context. However, the Bible does directly refer to godly jealousy. The title I gave you, I stole right out of one of Paul's writings. And then let's turn there over to 2 Corinthians chapter 11. You see, I lifted my title right from Paul's own statements. It's 2 Corinthians chapter 11. In verse 1. Oh, that you would bear with me in a little folly. And indeed you do bear with me, for I am jealous for you with godly jealousy. For I have betrothed you to one husband, that I may present you as a chaste virgin to Christ. Again, we normally don't think of jealousy as a godly quality. You know, we normally think of that as, you know, the opposite. And again, you know, carnal envy is. But we have to understand what's being referred to here. But just notice here that Paul says, you know, there is such a thing as godly jealousy. In fact, Paul also makes the comment that God himself can be provoked to jealousy. So let's turn over to 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and notice that. So 1 Corinthians 10, and we're going to start reading in verse 20. But I say the things which the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons and not to God. And I do not want you to have fellowship with demons. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You cannot partake of the Lord's table and the table of demons. Or do we provoke the Lord to jealousy? Are we stronger than he? I notice he's directly talking about God being provoked to jealousy. And again, you know, what we typically associate with the English words jealousy, we think, no, God wouldn't be jealous. You know, that wouldn't be something he would do. Well, we have to understand what he's referring to here. Because, you know, as I mentioned, the whole concept of selfishly desiring what is rightly someone else's and wanting to take it away, this is not a concept that would even, by definition, apply to God. What we're going to see when we look at this subject, when the Bible refers to God being jealous or having jealousy, we're referring specifically in the context of violations of the first and second commandments. Because your first commandment, you know, you shall have no other gods before me. Your second commandment, you shall not make graven images, you know, and bow down to them. Both of these are getting at a similar concept. It's basically not giving God the Father the respect and the, you know, and deference that he deserves, you know, and putting him as number one, as a priority. And it's basically looking to something else. We're replacing him in one way or another, you know, with some kind of substitute. You know, in honoring something else more than him is basically what this gets down to. And again, him having a problem with that is not him selfishly wanting to take what belongs to someone else. No, he rightfully, you know, deserves that respect and that honor. But one of the big lessons in all of this is we're going to see it is extremely important to him that he be honored in that role. He does not consider this negotiable. He absolutely demands that he be first in our lives and that we show him that proper respect. But again, you'll notice in the context, when we're going to look at a few examples here in just a moment, when we look at, you know, God being referred to as jealous or having jealousy, you're going to notice it's always in the context of violations of the first and second commandment. It's basically taking away, you know, the respect and honor that he deserves and giving it to someone or something else is basically in the context of where it's going to fall. Now, to notice some examples of this, turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 6. Deuteronomy chapter 6, we're going to start in verse 10. And it shall be when the Lord your God brings you into the land of which he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give you large and beautiful cities, which you did not build, houses full of all the good things, which you did not fill, hewn out of wells, which you did not dig, vineyards and olive trees, which you did not plant. And when you have eaten and are full, then beware lest you forget the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage. You shall fear the Lord your God and serve him, and shall take oaths in his name. You shall not go after other gods, the gods of the peoples who are all around you. For the Lord your God is a jealous God among you, lest the anger of the Lord your God be aroused against you and destroy you from the face of the earth. Now notice again, we're talking about, you know, direct violations of the first commandment. He's saying when you go in and take over these other nations, you know, don't be looking to their gods. Don't be giving them credit for what what God the Father did for them. You know, because he's saying, I did all this. I brought you out of Egypt. I gave you all of this. And don't get in here and get comfortable, you know, and then start getting distracted and looking at other gods and giving them honor for what I did for you. You know, so you can see it's very important to him that he be honored in the role, his rightful role. Again, there's nothing selfish or, you know, envious about this. He's simply demanding that we show him the proper respect. And, you know, and again, as we're going to see it as we go through this sermon, this is one of the big takeaways in this whole concept, is understanding that, as I like to kind of just put it in colloquial language, rule number one is not negotiable. You know, which, you know, the first commandment, you shall have no other gods before me, he is very serious about that, and he does not negotiate on that. In fact, he absolutely insists on it, and we're going to see a lot of examples of that. But notice, this is an example, as I mentioned, where jealous is mentioned in context of violations of the first commandment. You also see it specifically mentioned in violations of the second commandment. Now turn over to Exodus chapter 20. Exodus chapter 20. And we'll start reading in verse 4. You shall not make for yourself any carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them nor serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing mercy to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. Again, here we're talking about the second commandment, which again specifically is about idolatry or making images that we can, you know, worship. But again, we're getting at the same core concept of not showing God the proper respect and honor that he deserves and funneling that in some other direction, taking someone or someone else and, you know, placing that honor, you know, in devotion to that rather than to him. But again, I want you to notice just how serious he is about this. Because there's an interesting example that we're going to look at here in Deuteronomy chapter 4 that tells you just how strongly he feels about this issue of idolatry. So turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 4. In Deuteronomy chapter 4. And the context of in Deuteronomy chapter 4 and 5, you'll see a lot of this is Moses kind of recounting the story of you know, the Mount Sinai covenant, and then in all the, you know, the events that took place there and what, you know, what happened there. But notice, and this is what he's talking about here in the verses we're about to read. Again, it's Deuteronomy chapter 4 and verse 15. Take careful heed to yourselves, for you saw no form when the Lord your God spoke to you at Horeb out of the midst of the fire. Now take note of this verse. We're going to come back to this concept. He's talking about when God spoke the Ten Commandments from Mount Sinai. But, you know, he's making a big point here that you saw nothing. You saw the flames of a fire. You heard a loud voice, but you saw no kind of visual representation. And, you know, to take note of that, we're going to come back to this. And verse 16 tells us why. Lest you act corruptly and make for yourselves a carved image in the form of any figure, the likeness of male or female, the likeness of any beast that is on the earth, or the likeness of any winged bird that flies in the air, the likeness of anything that creeps on the ground, or the likeness of any fish that is in the water beneath the earth. And take heed, lest you lift your eyes to heaven, and when you see the sun, the moon, the stars, and all the host of heaven, you feel driven to worship them and serve them, which is the Lord your God has given to all the peoples under the whole heaven as a heritage. But the Lord your God has taken you and brought you out of the iron furnace, out of Egypt, to be his people, his inheritance, as you are this day. Furthermore, the Lord's angry for your sakes and swore, I would not cross over the Jordan, and I would not enter the good land which the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance. But I must die in this land. I must not cross over the Jordan, but you shall cross over and possess that good land. Take heed for yourselves, lest you forget the covenant which the Lord your God made with you, and make yourselves a carved image in the form of anything which the Lord your God has forbidden you. For the Lord your God is a consuming fire, a jealous God. Now notice once again here, we're talking about God being jealous, and once again, it's in the context of violations of the first and second commandment. But now I want you to know, I mean, I think this really states just how strongly he feels about the whole issue of idolatry. And just to point out here, as I mentioned here in verse 15, he makes a big point of when God spoke the Ten Commandments at Mount Sinai, all the Israelites, what they saw was just, you know, fire at the top of a mountain. They heard a booming voice, and they saw no form, no visual representation at all of God. Now, the Bible states in numerous places, very dogmatically, that no human being can see the face of God, the Father, and live to tell the story. That's very well documented in multiple scriptures. However, we also have to consider the example we see in Acts chapter 7. Now, again, I'm not going to turn there. It's a very famous story. It's the stoning of Stephen. But at the end of Stephen's life, when, you know, he's about to die because they're actively killing him, he makes the statement, "I see God and Jesus Christ standing next to him." Now, the narrative that Luke writes there makes a similar statement, and then Stephen makes the same statement as well. We can't debate who he's saying he sees. I mean, we can't say, is it one or is it the other? He clearly says, "I see God and Christ next to him." The narrative and Stephen's statements agree exactly. He's saying he sees both of them. Now, obviously, as I just mentioned, there are numerous scriptures that tell us no human being can see the face of God the Father and live to tell the story. You know, so we know whatever Stephen saw, he's not seeing the, you know, the face and detail of God the Father. Again, that's not possible, and the Bible clearly says that. Obviously, this has to mean, though, he saw some kind of visionary image, some kind of visual representation of God the Father. Again, we don't know exactly what he saw here, but again, that's the way you can reconcile those scriptures. He obviously saw something, you know, that he was inspired to understand was a representation of God the Father. Now, think about this in this context of what we just read in Deuteronomy 4. You know, because he specifically says, you know, God didn't allow you to see anything because you had made an image of it. Well, let's just follow the scenario of what if he had allowed them to see something similar to what he allowed Stephen to see. And he sees some visual representation. And they make an image of it. Now, understand this in the context. They're not making an image of Buddha or Dagon or a calf or the sun or the moon. They're making an image of whatever it is that God himself chose to let them see. And he forbids even that. Because this would have actually, again, been some kind of image of him, of himself. Because, again, he knows what they would have done with this. Because from their idolatrous background, they'd make this image, and this would start becoming a replacement. Because if you look at their history of how they handled the Ark of the Covenant, you can see the mindset of what can happen here. Because, you know, God did tell them exactly how to make the Ark of the Covenant. You know, gave them specific instructions, and they made this. You know, he told them how to use it. But there were also times in Israel's history where they got it in their heads, hey, as long as we got the Ark with us, we can't lose the battle. You know, doesn't matter if we're exactly following God's instructions and, you know, and doing what he tells us, we got this great Ark with us. You know, and as long as we got this, well, we just can't lose. Well, the Ark got captured, you know, and they had to learn that. Well, it didn't work that way. Because, see, they made an idol out of it. And see, that's what, you know, that's what this would have led to. That's why God said, no, not going to allow them to see anything. But I think it teaches us an important lesson of how he looks at idolatry and how strongly he feels about this. Because again, if they'd made an image of what he showed them as a representation of him, they're essentially making an image of him. You know, and not, again, this isn't Buddha or Dagon or some other pagan god. This is whatever he would have chosen to show them of a visual representation of himself. But again, but because that would have become a replacement. You know, and the honor and respect that should come to him would now, you know, they'd start treating it like a trinket, you know, like they did the Ark. He didn't want that, and he forbid that, because, you know, he demands that we show him the respect and the honor in a relationship with him. But again, this kind of tells you how important this is to him. But again, to further distinguish this, I'd like to share with you the meaning of the Hebrew word here for jealous that has been in all the scriptures that we've read so far and the one we're about to go to here in a minute. Now understand, this is not the only Hebrew word that is translated as jealous in English. You know, so there's more than one. But the meaning here gives you a good picture of what this is referring to when the Bible refers to God as being jealous. So the word here, again, used in all the examples in the Old Testament I've mentioned so far, and including here in Deuteronomy 4. It's transliterated as quanna. It's Q-A-N-N-A. In Strong's number 7067. And according to the Complete Word Study Dictionary of the Old Testament by Warren Baker and Eugene Carpenter, here's how it's defined. An adjective meaning jealous, In every instance of this word, it is used to describe the character of the Lord. He is a jealous God who will not tolerate the worship of other gods. This word is always used to describe God's attitude towards the worship of false gods, which arouses his jealousy and anger in judgment against the idol worshipers. So closely is this characteristic associated with God that his name is jealous. Now, this is a reference to the scripture we're about to turn to here. Because I mentioned in the introduction, there's one scripture in the Bible that specifically tells us his name is jealous, and it's referring to God. And again, the Hebrew word in that scripture is the one I just defined for you. Now turn over to Exodus 34, and we'll take a look at this. Exodus 34 and verse 10. And he said, "Behold, I make a covenant. Before all your people, I will do marvels such as has not been done in all the earth, nor in any nation, and all the people among whom you are shall see the work of the Lord, for it is an awesome thing that I will do with you. Observe what I command you this day. Behold, I am driving out from before you the Amorite and the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite. Take heed to yourself, lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land where you are going, lest it be a snare in your midst. But you shall destroy their altars, break their sacred pillars, cut down their wooden images. For you shall worship no other gods, for the Lord, whose name is jealous, is a jealous God." And notice it's saying that God's name is jealous, is what it's telling us. And verse 15, "Lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, and they play the harlot with their gods, and make sacrifice to their gods. And one of them invites you, and you eat of his sacrifice. And you take of his daughters for your sons, and his daughters play the harlot with their gods. And you make your sons play the harlot with their gods. You shall make no molded gods for yourselves." Now notice again, we're talking about violations of the first and second commandment here. But again, this tells us not only is he a jealous God, it goes so far as to say his name is jealous. Now, again, that's just not something we would typically ever associate with God. But we have to keep in mind, you know, what's meant here is, again, the meaning I just read to you. You know, this is not talking about selfish envy wanting to take what is someone else's. This is God demanding the proper honor and respect that he rightfully deserves. And again, this is a very, very big deal with him. He absolutely insists on being number one in our lives, you know, being honored from the top priority for where he should be, you know, and he's not willing to negotiate that. You know, it's not just something as long as it's convenient for us, you know, and as long as it doesn't inconvenience us, you know, that's not how this works. He absolutely demands on being number one in our lives. But I'd like to further explain the comment here. It says his name is God. I mean, his name is jealous, I should say. And now to think about that, realize I don't think that this is saying his proper name, you know, is jealous. In the same way that I would say my name is James, you know, that's my legal, you know, given name. You know, the word, you know, when we refer to a name in English, we can be referring to someone's proper legal name, or it can be, you know, a figurative statement. You know, sometimes people will joke, well, you know, my middle name is Trouble, you know, and they're not trying to say that legally their middle name is Trouble. They're just trying to say, I have a mischievous personality, you know, and they're making a joke because it's used figuratively. And so we have to understand the Hebrew word here for name can be used very similarly. Now, let me share with you this word. It's transliterated into English as Sem, S-E-M. It's Strong's number 8034. And again, according to the Complete Word Study Dictionary of the Old Testament by Warren Baker and Eugene Carpenter, here's how it's defined. A masculine noun meaning a name. Fame. It is what specifically identifies a person or anything. A person's name. To make a name for oneself means to obtain renowned reputation, as when God made Abraham's name great. To become famous is to have one's name spread through the land, and to have good name is to have a good character, a good reputation. So what you can see here is the Hebrew word here for name is can be used very similar to how we use, you know, the English word name. Again, we can be referring to someone's, you know, literal legal name, or we can be using it in a figurative sense. Now, I think this is better understood in a figurative sense. And let me explain why I say that. If you do a search, if you take a Bible search program, you know, there's numerous on the internet, and the one I always use is PC Study Bible. That's what's on my laptop, but there's lots of similar programs, you know, but where you can do kind of keyword searches, you know, and you can look at various scriptures throughout the Bible and, you know, study a subject. If you look at, you know, phrases like his name is, or my name is, or just name is, you know, and start looking at all the different verses throughout the Old Testament, and you look specifically for the ones it's referring specifically to God, you're going to see a very, very clear trend. In almost every case, with very few exceptions, well, what you're going to see is when it gives you a definition for his name, you're going to see in English, the Lord, Lord, L-O-R-D in all caps. It's the Hebrew word Yahweh. You're going to see either Yahweh used or an extended version of it. And what I mean by an extended version is it'll either just be Yahweh or, you know, or the Lord, or it'll be the Lord of hosts, the Lord God of your fathers, you know, or some extended version, you know, where there's more words there. But you're going to see that in almost every case. You know, and the reason I mention that, you know, this verse that we just read here is one of the exceptions. There's only a couple of exceptions to that. But you see this very, very clear trend. Now, if you've ever looked up the Hebrew word, you know, any of the, I said studied into the Hebrew word Yahweh or Jehovah, and personally, I don't think the pronunciation is a big deal, you know, exactly how it's spelled. Whenever you're transliterating between two different languages that don't share the same alphabet, you're going to have guesses and variations in spelling. You know, if you pay attention to, you know, lexicons and such of how they handle words in Hebrew or even in Greek, you're going to see variations in spelling. You know, they don't all spell it exactly the same way because they're making some guesses here. And that's kind of inherent. So understand, I'm not one that makes a big deal out of pronunciation there or exact spelling. I don't think that matters. But you get down to, you'll typically see this as YHVH, you know, or it's referred to as the Tetragrammaton. And if you look into the history of how the Jews handled this word, now, in my opinion, they went way overboard. You know, they tried to teach this, you know, is this is just, you know, too sacred to be pronounced. And in fact, oftentimes in their writings, they would replace it. And what they would put is Hashem, the name, is what they would put in there. Now, there's a reason why they do that. It's the personal name of the God of Israel. Because if you even look at all the documentation that talks about this, they'll tell you that's exactly the reason why. It's the personal name of the God of Israel. And that's why they referred to it as the name. You know, and again, they went overboard in making it, you know, too sacred to be pronounced and how they treated it. But again, it is his personal name. And again, if you start studying and looking at all the different scriptures that you know, talk about his name is or my name is, in almost every case, you're going to see that utilized. You know, and again, it's the most used, you know, phrase to, you know, or name to refer to God throughout the Bible. It's literally over 6,000 times that you'll see this used. And as a result of that, it's oftentimes debated, well, is this specific to, you know, God the Father, or is this a generic name? You know, is it shared, you know, between him and Christ? And I have to admit, for much of my life, I was one that would debate that subject as well. However, then I came across, in studying this subject, what I think is the defining scripture that just really nails this subject down. Turn over to Psalm chapter 83. Psalm chapter 83. We're going to look at verse 18. Then men may know that you, whose name alone is the Lord. Now, if you look at that again in a lexicon, you're going to see that's the whose name alone is Yahweh. That's what it's saying. Notice it says whose name alone. We're saying there's only one individual. There's one individual who alone has this name. Now, notice the next phrase. Are the Most High over all the earth. So what it says is there's one individual alone who has the name Yahweh, and he's also known as the Most High. That pretty well nails down this subject. Because if you look at the title, the Most High, I mean, just to give you some easy examples, you'll see Christ stated in the New Testament as being the Son of the Most High. As Melchizedek in the Old Testament, he's the priest of the Most High. It's obviously we're referring to the Father as the Most High. Look up the Hebrew words for Most High and the Greek and look at their meanings. What you're going to see is they both make it very clear the individual being referred to here is the one in the very highest position. You know, it's kind of at the top of the totem pole, as we would say in modern day English. You know, well, if you think about that, you've got two God beings, and Christ made it very clear, my Father is greater than myself. You know, even after he's back to being a God being, he states repeatedly, you know, he's my God, you know, and I'm in submission to him. Okay, you have a superior subordinate relationship. If we're talking about the individual at the very top, there's only one of those. By definition, you can't have two. It just wouldn't work that way. You know, so if you've only got one individual named Yahweh, and he's also the Most High, God the Father is Yahweh. You know, and if you want to think of how to, I guess this is something that helped me when I was studying this subject, conceptualize this subject, and I'm just going to share it. Hopefully it will be, you know, helpful to some of the others that are hearing this. And to give you a little background, I'll have to kind of explain a little bit of the context for this to make sense. But in my job, I worked for I'm a corporate recruiter for a hospital system. It's a large hospital system, kind of the biggest one in Texas, and we have a dedicated research institute. And the majority of my job is doing all the staffing for the research institute. You know, so I'm oftentimes finding, you know, staff and personnel that are work on research projects. But oftentimes these projects are headed up by either a physician or a PhD scientist who's overseeing, you know, a particular area of research. And oftentimes these guys have diverse careers. You know, they have very accomplished individuals, and they oftentimes wear a lot of hats and different titles that they work with. You know, and sometimes I'll be emailing some of them, and they'll typically have a signature at the bottom of their emails, because, you know, in the world I work in, most everybody has like an email signature kind of identifying who they are as they're emailing back and forth. Well, and I'm just going to make up a name here for illustration purposes. Let's just say for our purposes here, we're talking about Dr. Robert Jones. But what you'll see in his email signature is, again, his proper name is Robert Jones, because that's his legal name that he goes by. But you'll oftentimes see a list of titles below that also describe him. Because if he's the head of a particular research, he's oftentimes referred to as a principal investigator. He's principal investigator of XYZ research. But he may also head up a department. So he's director of, and it lists the department. He may also be listed as chairman of. It may be committees or professional organizations he's involved with or boards that he sits on. He may also teach at a university nearby. And he's referred to as professor of. So you have this one name and a handful of titles, you know, that this individual is known as, because these are roles and offices that they fulfill. Well, again, from an analogy standpoint, if God the Father had an email signature, I think it would look like this. His personal name, Yahweh, the Lord, L-O-R-D in all caps. But then there's a big list of titles and offices that he holds. The Most High, the Almighty, the Living God, the Ancient of Days. You know, you could list a whole number of them. But again, the personal name of the God of Israel is Yahweh, the Lord. Again, that's why it's used 6,000 times. But the point I'm getting at in all of this is, again, that's his personal name, but again, name can be used figuratively. So you'll see, again, there's only one time in the Bible you'll see it listed, his name is Jealous. It's not telling us that his, you know, his literal legal name is Jealous. This is such a major part of his character that you could refer to him, you know, like this. You know, this is a very important descriptor of who he is. And this tells us a lot about not only God's character, but it teaches us some important lessons about our relationship with him. Because if this is so important to him that you could say his name is this, you know, and you see how seriously then he takes violations of the first and second commandments. You know, that this is very important to him, that he be honored as number one in our lives, that he receives the proper respect. Because, see, oftentimes we think of just, you know, the first and second commandments as, you know, literally worshiping, you know, Buddha or Dagon or, you know, some completely false god, or, you know, or bowing down to an image or a golden calf or something of that nature. No, violations of the first and second commandment for us can be putting anything else as a greater priority than God. You know, that can be disrespecting and replacing him. Now, again, not just in our words, but in our actions, you know, and how we show proper respect to him. And it's very important to understand that God has a well-documented track record of testing people on this issue. You know, and those of you that know me well know I'm kind of a broken record in saying the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior. The reason is because I'm a recruiter. You know, when you're interviewing people, the primary thing you're looking at is their past performance and decisions they've made. That's the best predictor of what they'll do in the future. Well, if we apply this to God, If you're dealing with an individual who says, I am the Lord, I do not change. In other words, he's extremely consistent. That means his past behavior is an extremely good predictor of his future behavior. And we're going to see he is very well documented, you know, on this subject of absolutely insisting that we put him first in our lives and of putting people to the test to make sure when the pressure's on and when it gets hot, you know, for us and it gets uncomfortable, that's the decisions that we're going to make. So let's understand this is a well-documented part of his character and what he expects from us and how we should live our lives. And just to notice, as I mentioned, he's well-documented on this. So let's just look at a couple examples. Turn over to Genesis chapter 22. Genesis chapter 22, and we're going to start in verse 1. Now, this is the story of Abraham and Isaac. And, I mean, if you're familiar, I'm sure you're probably familiar with Abraham in the Bible. He's a very, very popular biblical figure. You know, and I mean, at the time that this event happens, Abraham's had a long track record with God. I mean, he packed up and moved when God told him to. He has been described as the friend of God. You know, he's you know, had lots of promises. He's shown a lot of faithfulness. But God is still testing him to make sure that, you know, Abraham is willing to forsake everything and put him first. So let's notice here in Genesis 22 in verse 1. Now it came to pass after these things that God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham, and he said, here I am. And he said, take now your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah. Offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you. So Abraham rose early in the morning and saddled his donkey and took two of his young men with him, and Isaac his son, and he split the wood for a burnt offering and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. And on the third day, Abraham lifted his eyes and saw the place afar off. And Abraham said to his young men, stay here with the donkey. The lad and I will go yonder and worship, and he will come back to you. So Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac his son. And he took the fire in his hand and a knife, and the two of them went together. And Isaac spoke to Abraham his father and said, my father. And he said, here I am, my son. And he said, look, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for a burnt offering? And Abraham said, my son, God will provide for himself the lamb for a burnt offering. And the two of them went together. And they came to the place of which God had told him. And Abraham built an altar there and placed the wood. It was the wood there, and placed the wood in order. And he bound Isaac his son and laid him on the altar upon the wood. And Abraham stretched out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, here I am. And he said, do not lay your hand on the lad or do anything to him. For now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. I noticed that this was a test. You know, he was putting him to the test, as the verse 1 told us. You know, God is testing Abraham, and he wants to see, are you going to do this? Now, again, it's easy for us to academically look at this story, because we know how it all ends. You know, we know he goes through the motions and nobody ever really gets hurt and everybody goes home fine afterwards. But stop and put yourself in Abraham's shoes. You know, he waits 25 years to have a son. He finally has him. His son grows up. And then God says, you know what? Take that boy up the mountain and kill him for me. Imagine the emotional turmoil that Abraham is going through dealing with this and what a test this was for him. You know, so God puts him to the test to make sure he's going to go through it. And once he realizes, yeah, this guy's really going to do it, okay, stop. Didn't really want you to kill him, but I wanted to see that you will put me first, even when it's painful for you. Even when it's difficult and it's traumatic and it's hard for you, that you're going to put me first. You see, he insists on being first. Again, he has a very well-documented track record. And the reason I point this out is because, you know, in our culture today, we have a society that very much thinks that we should never have to be uncomfortable. You know, we should never have to face anything too difficult. We should never, you know, ever have our feelings hurt or be offended or have anything difficult. Well, it's really easy to put God in that context and go, well, he would never do anything that, you know, would offend somebody and would hurt like that. Well, that wouldn't be loving. Well, think about this. I mean, let me just put in another example with this for Abraham. Now, again, we can only speculate about this because the Bible is completely silent about Sarah's reaction to all of this. So, again, everything I'm saying here is just complete speculation just to get us to think about this. But again, imagine the typical mom, because most women who are moms, even if they're real mild-mannered, if you want to watch them come unglued, threaten one of their kids. You know, my mom was like one of those, like that. I mean, if you threatened one of us as little kids, you'd see the mama bear come out, you know, to defend one of her children. Well, just imagine the conversation of one day, you know, when God tells Abraham to do this, and Abraham talks to Sarah and says, well, you know, honey, the son that you waited 25 years for and you'd finally given up on the idea of having kids to the point that you sarcastically mocked the idea that you'd ever be a mom, and you finally had a son and you raised him, well, God's told me to take him out and kill him, and I'm going to do it. You know, imagine the reaction that this could bring about in the emotional turmoil, you know, that they could go through having to deal with these decisions. Again, my point is in realizing that God insists on us, you know, us to put him first in our lives. He absolutely demands it. And again, that can be when it's uncomfortable for us. That can be when our own lives are on the line, when our jobs are on the line. You know, when we lose, you know, we could lose friends and have our name slandered and, you know, and go through lots of difficult trials. But again, we have to keep in mind, rule number one is not negotiable. You know, God didn't say, you know, put me first. Well, as long as it doesn't become too difficult for you, you know, as long as you don't lose any friends and you don't hurt anybody's feelings or it doesn't become painful for you, certainly wouldn't want you to lose your life. You know, he doesn't say any of that. In fact, his track record is the exact opposite. You know, I mean, you can give lots of examples here of people who went through very harsh trials because God was testing them to see, are you going to put me first? Even when it's painful, you know, even when you're going through very difficult situations, are you going to choose to put me first in spite of the ramifications that could happen to your life? Because he demands that kind of commitment. And again, this book is full of examples that document that very thing. And again, just think of it in terms of my favorite statement, you know, best predictor of future behavior is past behavior. God's past behavior is very well documented on this one. You know, we don't have to speculate. We know what he thinks, but because it's very clearly stated. And see, Jesus Christ gave us examples, you know, stating this very thing and making this very clear of how important this principle is. So turn over to Luke chapter 14. Luke chapter 14, we'll start reading here in verse 25. Now this is the familiar counting the cost scriptures that you probably all covered going through baptismal counseling. And great multitudes went with him, and he turned and said to them, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his father, mother, wife, and children, brothers and sisters, yes, his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. And who does ever not bear his cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. For which of you, intending to build a tower, does not sit down first and count the cost, whether he has enough to finish it? Lest after he has laid the foundation and is not able to finish it, all those who see it begin to mock him, saying, this man began to build and was not able to finish. Or what king going to make war against another king does not sit down first and consider whether he is able with 10,000 to meet him who comes against him with 20,000? Or else, while the other is still a great way off, he sends a delegation and asks conditions of peace. So likewise, whoever of you cannot forsake all that he has cannot be my disciple. Notice how serious he is about this. He's saying you have to put this above your own life, your own friends, your own spouse. I mean, God has to be the first priority over everything. And there can be nothing else in our life that's more important than him. Because see, it's not just the issue of, you know, for example, taking the example, I'm sure you're familiar with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, when, you know, when Nebuchadnezzar puts up an image and says, you know, when you hear the music, I want you guys to bow down to this. You know, and he's literally telling them to, you know, literally physically bow down to an idol. You know, well, you know, these guys literally refused even at threat of their own lives. I mean, their response is, you know, oh, Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. You know, our God is able to save us from this. But just for the record, even if he doesn't, we're still not bowing down to this. We're willing to burn, you know, before we're willing to bow down to your idol. You know, because they had faith that even if God didn't save them from that, they'd come upon the first resurrection and they'd be ultimately rewarded for this. You know, but they understood where the priorities had to be, even if that was in threat of their own life. And see, we have to understand this in our own, you know, in our own day-to-day life, even if it's now, you know, we tend to think in terms of idolatry as, again, the Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego example. You know, physically bending down to a physical idol and such there. Well, the same thing can happen simply because we put something else in our lives, someone, something, you know, whether it's a relationship, whether it's our possessions, whatever it is, and we make it more important than God. And then we think, well, this is something we got to put as a greater priority, and it comes out in our actions, not just in our words of what we say. And we have to realize how important this is to God. And again, let's look at a couple more examples here before we wrap up. Let's turn over to Matthew chapter 19. Because Christ makes this clear in several examples of just how big of a deal this is. So Matthew chapter 19 and verse 16. Now behold, one came and said to him, "Good teacher, what good thing shall I do that I may have eternal life?" And he said to him, "Why do you call me good? No one is good but one, that is God. And if you want to enter into life, keep the commandments." And he said to him, "Which ones?" And Jesus said, "You shall not murder, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness, honor your father and mother, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself." And the young man said to him, "All these things I have kept from my youth, what do I still lack?" And Jesus said, "If you want to be perfect, go sell what you have and give to the poor, and you shall have treasure in heaven, and come follow me." But when the young man heard that saying, he went away sorrowful, for he had great possessions. So you notice that this isn't a guy who's just being derelict and totally, you know, and abandoning everything that God has to say, you know, and what he commands, because, you know, this guy's response to Christ is, well, I've been keeping these basic commandments my whole life, you know, I'm committed to that. You know, and Christ didn't say, "Oh no, you're a liar. You know, you're not really doing any of that." Christ said, "Okay, what about your possessions? You know, you're a wealthy guy. Give that up." I notice this guy's reaction is, you know, from his behaviors, "I like my stuff now. I worked hard for these good things. Now I'm not giving that up. Now, I mean," or to put it in modern day terminology, we tend to joke, it'd be kind of like he was saying, "Well, you didn't quit preaching and gone to meddling now, Christ. You know, I mean, you're asking me to give up my nice stuff now. That's too much." You know, well, I mean, that's how we tend to think. It's like, well, you can ask all these other things, but don't ask me to give that up. You know, now that's important. And so you have to realize God looks at it from the standpoint of we can't put anything else above him. Now, this is what the whole concept of him being jealous teaches us. He is not willing to accept us making him, you know, a second priority in our lives. You know, we can't rationalize around it and say, well, you know, this would be too uncomfortable. I can't give that up. You know, I can't lose friends over this. I can't lose my job over this. You know, you got to be reasonable. You know, no, that's not how he looks at it. He looks at it from the standpoint, you got to put him first, even if we lose our own life. You know, and Christ even tells us again, if we're not willing to do this, we can't be in the kingdom of God. It's that big of an issue for God. So turn over to Luke chapter 9. Luke chapter 9 and verse 57. Now it happened as they journeyed on the road that someone said to him, Lord, I will follow you wherever you go. And Jesus said to him, foxes have holes, birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. Then he said to another, follow me. But he said, Lord, let me first go and bury my father. And Jesus said to him, let the dead bury their own dead, but you go and preach the kingdom of God. And another also said, Lord, I will follow you, but let me first go and bid farewell to who are at my house. But Jesus said to him, no one having put his hand to the plow and looking back is fit for the kingdom of God. Now again, notice the examples. These are not situations where people are saying, you know, forget that guy and forget his bio. I don't want anything to do with that. You know, I'm just going to go live, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll and turn my back on this. This is not what's happening. You know, these are people saying, no, I've got something else that's more important. You know, this is good, but I got something a little more important I got to do. You know, and they're basically putting God as a second priority. God's not okay with that. That's the whole issue of him saying he's a jealous God. Because we need to understand God has a very well-documented track record. He absolutely insists on us putting him as top priority. And he will absolutely test us on that. Again, he has a very well-documented track record on this. I mean, coming down to punching whatever is the button of something that we put before others, whether that's our job, whether that's our profession, whether that's our spouse, or appeasing other people's feelings, or maybe being popular in the sight of others. You know, whatever it is that gets to us, that's the very thing he's going to say, well, you got to give that up. That's why with Abraham and Isaac, it's you waited 25 years for this son, kill the son for me. You know, it's to make sure that God is number one above everything else. Now realize God knows that we're human and we're going to make mistakes and we're never going to be perfect. But again, he's going to test us to make sure that that's our desire and that's what we're striving to do. And the evidence is going to be in our behavior, not just in the words that we say. So when you look at the subject, again, of God being jealous, let's understand that, first of all, this is not at all referring to the carnal envy that we think of when we think of human beings being jealous. That's a very negative, carnal, sinful thing. You know, that has nothing to do with what God means when he's jealous. But the lesson in looking that God is a jealous God, that his name is jealous, it's such a part of his character, he describes it figuratively as his name, is because of how important the first commandment is to him. That we put him as first, as the top priority in our lives, and that there's nothing else in our lives. You know, not our family, not our job, not anything else that we're willing to put before him. So just think of it like this. The lesson in this subject is the Lord our God is a jealous God, and he absolutely insists on being first in our lives.